Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this next session, which is an extended session on the risk landscape. As you might notice, we have three people sat on the stage rather than four. Unfortunately, due to operational issues, Ian Levy from the NCSC isn't able to join us today. But I'm delighted to say that James and Rick have worked together to create a really great session. You'll have lots of opportunity during the session to ask questions on Slido. I think you'll obviously be engaged throughout. So I'm going to hand straight over to Pete Wood, who is the moderator of the session, and I hope you enjoy this session. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Okay, at the back there, give me a quick wave, please. Hello, Alan. Thank you. Okay, good. So, good afternoon. Welcome to this session on risks, threats, and adversaries. Or adversaries, depending which side of the Atlantic you're from. I'm delighted to be participating. I've got a... Oh, I was really hoping that would work. Ah, just a second. Foiled by the technology again.
It's working over there.
Yes, okay.
AV boat, we need your mojo.
Yes, some mojo. In the meantime, not being able to see the amusing photograph, I won't describe it to you, but we'll bring that up in a second. I am joined by two luminaries of the industry who I count as my friends. Rick Ferguson, special advisor to Europol EC3 and an Info Security Hall of Fame alumnus, and James Lynn, who appears to be appearing with a much smaller title today, that of security researcher. I think you'll find both of their presentations pretty illuminating. They're both very good speakers.
Keep talking, Pete.
Yes. Let's think about something else to say for a moment. So, Rick, how was your travel here today?
It was a shit show, to be honest.
Was it?
Yeah. Rain and London don't mix.
Yeah.
And black cabs get stuck.
Right.
So, apologies to Eleanor, because I already missed the filming session with her earlier on. Apparently, I'm already in a bad books.
James, how was your journey today?
I actually had a wonderful journey here, which is, of course, an abhorrent lie, because everyone has the same answer when it comes to travelling through London in the rain. Yeah. But I had a wonderful, wonderful conversation with a cab driver who told me all about WannaCry.
Yeah.
It's one of my things. When I get into a cab, social engineering practice, I like to make up a different career. And I've been, you know, kind of rocket scientist, garbage man, footballer, and it does get awkward when they find you out sometimes and you have to tell them that everything you've just told them is a lie. But in this particular occasion, I was not a cybersecurity professional, so he educated me about WannaCry, which was fascinating.
Did he think you were Josh Widdicombe?
He did think I was Josh Widdicombe. So did someone on a train the other day, actually. They wanted to take a photo with me, of which, of course, I said yes.
So there's an Englishman, Irishman, and a Scotsman. So tell them that joke, Pete, that you told us before you came on.
We both went the pregnant pause there, didn't we? I've been giving presentations for decades now, and it doesn't matter how technical the audience or how technical the venue or how technical the presenter, no one can ever get a laptop to work. Why is this?
The laptop's working fine. It's James's own laptop. You can trust that.
Yeah, is it a MacBook or is it a Microsoft device?
It's not a Microsoft device.
No.
It does have Windows on it in various places, which I mostly use to run malware. I do have an Apple clone as well. I like to run malware in that as well, which is great fun. Of course, Apple like to deny that that's a thing. But that's good fun.
Yes, I thought Apple devices were immune from viruses.
I'll let you field that one.
Yes, so do many people.
Yes.
What more can I say?
Not much, really.
So, you know, if it doesn't work soon, we could always start with some questions and then go back to the talks.
We could, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose we might. He does look nervous. I think he needs some time. He's rewiring things.
Do you need a pinout diagram?
Now, that's a bit harsh. Right, I think we should go for a show of hands. This is always good fun. How many people are at their first Info Security Europe?
Wow, that's surprisingly more than I thought it would be.
How many people thought that the keynote presentation would actually have slides? Okay.
Sure. Wing it.
Well, there we are. We are going to start with some questions.
Great. We've winged the rest of it so far.
Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to just use Slido initially just to get a few questions from the audience to start off with, just while my colleague tries to look at what's going on with the laptop. So we'll pull up Slido now, and we've also got a couple of poll questions that we'll push out to you as well, and then we'll get this presentation back on track. Thank you.
Fantastic.
I didn't do it.
No.
Wasn't me.
Right. Oh, here we go. Okay, a poll question for you, ladies and gentlemen. What do you feel is the most significant vulnerability to cyber attack? Insufficient skilled people or budget for defending the organization? Legacy systems and or patching problems? I don't think we've got any clients on our book to have that problem. Oh, look at that. Some combination of the above is looking popular. Oh.
Of the people that click legacy and or patching problems, how many would have clicked that pre-WannaCry?
Looking good. This is really quite a sexy application, isn't it? It's quite good, this. I'm very disappointed no one's been brave enough to click on "we don't consider ourselves significantly vulnerable" with two of the best hackers on the planet on the stage. That's such a missed opportunity. Ah, thank you.
It had to happen, right? That was like, fuck you. I've got a microphone on, haven't I? Yeah. Sorry about that. Oh,
all right, poll question two. Do you use threat and risk analysis to identify potential threat actors? Anybody who knows me will be surprised to learn that I wrote this poll question, but do you use threat and risk analysis? Oh, 31% have it, so there's only three people voted, mind you. Look at that. Who is that person that keeps clicking the option you're not supposed to select? That's really
someone's
really good.
Running the burp suite and just like running the intruder again and again and again and upvoting.
Well, every time that 2% appears, it's when you walk closer to that keyboard, isn't it?
So 30% of the audience have a well-defined process for threat and risk analysis. If only you were typical of the corporate landscape, that would be fantastic. And a lack of resources or skills coming second, which is interesting. Got to be a consultancy opportunity there, I'd have thought. And 26%. Okay. It's neck and neck for informally and don't have the skills.
What are the odds?
3-1 on. Okay, so what comes next in Pete World after a threat and risk analysis is moving on to a red team engagement to actually test the concepts that you've defined during the TARA exercise. Thank you. There's a 3% person again. Well, look at that. I'd have said 2 years ago, the idea of getting 20% of people having red teaming as a well-defined process would have been really, really exceptional.
And as you said that, it slipped back under 20%.
Oh, 19's close though, isn't it?
And now, snow.
Those were the three poll questions, I think. 44% don't have the resources or skills. Very interesting. Very interesting. Educational opportunity for somebody there, I suspect.
They're like 1 point. Oh, move on. It's not. It's got text on it.
Oh. Rick. Oh, there was a question flashed up there in a sort of stroboscopic fashion just now that I thought you'd like to answer, but it's gone again.
WannaCry, what was that all about?
Yeah. What was that all about then?
What was that all about? WannaCry is funny. Yeah, it does seem, I forget what the word was on the slide, that it seemed inconsistent in many ways or something like that. True. It looked like a very amateurish attempt to weaponize something very very professional. So using the exploit vulnerability leaked by the shadow brokers developed by National Intelligence Agency of a certain Western country. But the implementation of that seemed amateurish at best. What was it all about? Well, it was certainly about making money like ransomware is in general. There's limited circumstantial evidence that some people have said points to the involvement of North Korea. We've seen also limited circumstantial evidence pointing to North Korea being involved in attacks on the SWIFT system for also gaining access to finances. You can understand why a country like North Korea would be interested in gaining access to finances, because it's something that they can work with. But it was done very unprofessionally. The coding was shoddy, the encryption was shoddy, the decryption was shoddy, the key management and the decryption process itself was poorly designed. And I think, first and foremost, out of all the things that was wrong with it, it broke the, the best way to phrase it, but it broke the trust model that ransomware feeds on. Ransomware is one of those crimes that, oddly enough, relies on an honest criminal, if I can put it like that. It relies on the fact that if you pay the ransom, you get your data back. And the more it becomes apparent that if you pay the ransom, you don't get your data back, the less likely people are to pay the ransom. And I think that could be the single biggest silver lining to do with WannaCry. There are a few others that I could mention, but the single biggest one, I think, is that it may have killed the goose that laid the golden egg from a criminal perspective, because it's made people aware that even if they do pay the ransom, there's no guarantee they're going to get their data back, and that they do have to focus on other methods of recovery and mitigation from those kinds of attacks. Not to mention the media attention that it got has really boosted ransomware's profile outside of simply the security industry, and hopefully people are going to pay a little more attention to vulnerability management, patch management, legacy systems, backup management. So I think there's a lot of good stuff that's going to come out of WannaCry, but it was, inconsistent with the ransomware that's come before. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Jimbo.
No, you've got to quote the taxi driver, right?
Yeah, I love the taxi, and that's got a lot of upvotes as well. So actually, he really knew quite a lot about WannaCry, and it just shows you how some of these campaigns can all of a sudden gain this global interest. You know, people that normally aren't involved in our community just all of a sudden have all these amazing facts. I think the one thing that was slightly concerning was he'd obviously listened a lot to the "who built WannaCry" message. And he's like, well, you know, why are the North Koreans coming after me? Well, hold on, we don't know that. Attribution's a little more difficult than that. And that's hardly the point, actually. To his understanding as well, this particular attack was a bit of a one-off, and he wasn't so familiar with the absolute deluge of ransomware that's out there day to day. So if there was a silver lining to WannaCry, it is that it brings this stuff back to the attention and reminds people, but it can also skew people's perspective a little bit about what's actually happening day to day. But yes, he gave me some great tips on how to clean my computer up, which is wonderful.
So you're okay now?
It's all sorted. It's
fine. Did he recommend any particular product?
He didn't. No, I thought that would have been rude to ask that question. But
okay. Who wants to field the question about the biggest hack against Apple?
I can't believe we're allowing Anonymous to ask questions. Surely they know.
And for some reason, their logos changed.
What's been the biggest hack on Apple? That's a very interesting question. Do you mean against the company themselves or against their devices? I don't. Now, Anonymous, unmask yourself. What do you mean? I mean, we've had no massive publicity about a data breach at Apple, so I have to assume you mean against the devices that they manufacture and release. Well, the first ever virus was targeted at Apple systems, not Macintosh, but Apple systems, and malware for Apple devices has been ongoing since then. So yeah, we've seen Trojans, we've seen ransomware, we've seen botnets, all of those targeted at Apple in far lower volume, of course, than we've seen targeted at the Wintel platform, but that's not because it's inherently more secure, it's because it's inherently a much, or historically has been inherently a much smaller target. So you'll get less return on your criminal investment if you're going after Apple. Where we do see interest and investment when it comes to Apple is more from the people who are interested in buying and selling vulnerabilities, whether that's the people trading in the vulnerabilities or the people paying for them. And most often that's people at nation state level or people at corporate espionage level. The most valuable vulnerabilities and or exploits out there are the ones really that are aimed at iOS as an operating system, and that can be weaponized and used against those kinds of devices, I guess because they're perceived as being higher value targets. And probably also because Apple has done comparatively a very good job of keeping the App Store clean of malicious software. It's not a 100% spotless environment. There have been a couple that have sneaked through. But by and large, it's a significantly better job than has been done even in the official Google Play App Store environment, and certainly within the third-party environments that provide apps for Android devices. So what has been the biggest one? For my money, it's still malware that's been aimed at macOS type systems rather than any other device.
I think the only thing I'd add to that, now that I'm not hovering next to my computer to mash buttons.
Can I go and hover next to your computer?
You can absolutely do that. The only thing I'd add is that there's an interesting challenge with the ecosystem. I totally agree that the walled garden philosophy has made, that's really creepy, has made a lot of applications, a lot of malicious applications more focused towards Android. But there's also a real challenge of opaqueness, a lack of transparency.
Yeah.
The backflips that you have to perform as a security researcher to look at an application on an iOS device and decide, is it good, is it bad, is it handling your information accurately? For a start, you need a jailbroken phone, which isn't always trivial. Once you've got a jailbroken phone, you've got a hodgepodge of different tools that lack maturity compared to Android, and it's really difficult to actually do that inspection. Net result, in a recent run through a lot of legitimate applications, there's a lot of really bad practice in crypto and information sharing, weak APIs and authentication.
Yeah.
So there's less malware, but maybe the position of trust isn't as deserved as many would think, and they're getting away with it by virtue of that opaqueness.
Yeah, and it's the same story as macOS has always been. It's a position of trust unearned.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with desktop OSs from Apple as well.
You're all very patient. Thank you for sticking with us through that.
And by the way, the photo, very importantly, is either, and I'm not sure, whether it's Rick Lynn or James Ferguson.
It's Rhymes Linnison.
Rhymes Linnison is better.
Is it? Thank you. So that's we were going to use that to amuse you during the introduction. I think as a flat party balloon, it's done quite a good job. So, Rick, I think you're on first.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so let's go back to what we were supposed to be doing. So
you'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah. I wanted a cup of tea, otherwise I was quite comfortable. So with Ian Levy unable to join us, James and I had to cobble together something last minute. This is what we've come up with. We've hopefully managed to at least make some kind of seam between what I'm going to say and what James is going to say. I hesitate to be the one standing here saying it, but I'm up here to give James something to drill into. I think that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. So, I want to talk about the broader, more higher level threat. It took me ages to come up with that while I was sitting there thinking. The broader, more higher level threat landscape stuff, and hopefully James is going to put some more meat on the bones. There's no stopping me this morning. Some more meat on the bones as we go through. So, Because it was the session was initially about risks and adversaries. Oh, the other thing, God, we're not supposed to be talking for ages, but I have a feeling we're going to. The other thing, we really wanted to leave an empty chair for Ian from NCSC, because the reason he couldn't join us for a Q&A is related to Purdo with the election. He's got to be careful what he says and where, because he's working in the civil service. And I wanted to be able to stand here and point at the empty chair and say, that's what Purdo does to you. Don't do Purdo. But I can't, but I managed to squeeze it in anyway. So, yes, the risk landscape. This is data from the World Economic Forum, and you can see that in terms of likelihood, both cyber attacks and data theft or fraud are ranked for 2017 as highly likely. And obviously what we've seen in the first half of this year kind of bears out that assessment. It is highly likely, and I think so far, also the weighting for impact is relatively correct as well. If you're going to be the victim of a highly targeted nation-state sponsored or driven or aligned attack, then you can argue that the fallout and the damage from that could be significantly higher. But I think for the vast majority of online crime and online attacks and data breaches, the impact is certainly nowhere up there with an earthquake or some other natural disaster. You've got to consider these things weighted appropriately. And you've also got to consider that not all of us are firmly in the crosshairs of nation-state-sponsored adversaries. There are only specific organizations or specific individuals that are really of interest to groups like PornStorm, APT28, those kinds of groups. If you're in government, if you're in telecoms, if you're in media, if you're in defense manufacturing, then you need to pay a little more attention to those kinds of attacks. But not everybody is in the crosshairs of those really high-impact attacks. So what kind of things have we seen over the course of 2016 and into 2017? Well, we've certainly seen an evolution of ransomware. Ransomware has a long and inglorious history going all the way back to 1988. The PC Cyborg, or the AIDS Trojan that came on a floppy disk. And we've seen a lot of evolution over time. But where it really took off, what we really could say was the year of ransomware, the year when we saw an exponential increase, was last year, over the last 12 months. You know, it started, as I said, way back with the AIDS Trojan, PC Cyborg Trojan. We went through WinLocker-type ransomware that wasn't doing any encryption, through the advent of CryptoLocker being added to Black Hole Exploit Kit, and then it really started to get some traction. We thought 2015 was bad, but then when we view 2015 in context, in terms of what we've seen as evolution in unique families of ransomware out there, I think just by looking at the graph, you can really get a sense of how impactful 2016 has been, and also what that consequently means, how much time, effort, and finance the criminals have been throwing at ransomware in terms of recognizing that it's a great vehicle for generating money and getting a solid return on that investment. Cyber criminals, online criminals are very practical. If something doesn't generate an income, they'll walk away from it and start using something that does. And you can see just from the shape of that hockey stick on the screen that over the course of 2016, ransomware has generated considerable income and considerable interest. So 29 new families of ransomware in 2015, and as you can see, 246 different families of ransomware over the next 12 months, the course of 2016. Almost a 750% increase. Those are Trend Micro figures, but it's not just, you know, this isn't a one organization thing. So I pulled some figures from some other people. You know, PhishMe are saying 97% of all the phishing emails that they saw in the third quarter of 2016 contain crypto ransomware. Infoblox were looking at domains that were increased 35-fold. So as an industry, we agree that 2016 really has been the year of ransomware. It's something criminals have focused on. Like I said, with WannaCry may have killed the goose that laid the golden egg, I think we're going to see ransomware development at least plateau, if not begin to drop off a bit. I think this rate of expansion and investment won't continue. And the more that we do as organizations and as individuals to not pay the ransom is really going to contribute to that criminals moving on to some other means of making money. And there, unfortunately, of course, are other means. There's been some great cross-industry collaboration. If you haven't looked at or heard of the No More Ransom Project, which is headed up by Europol, organized by Europol, have a look at nomoreransom.org. where decryption tools and advice are available from every major manufacturer to help you recover from a ransomware incident and to give you good usable advice on what you can do to avoid one in the future. And there's a heavy focus from security industry and from law enforcement on making sure that we make a dent in this as an ecosystem. So best practices in a nutshell, what can you do? This is stuff that we should all know about. I'm sure many of us in the room remember making backups to tape, and somebody, it was their turn every week to take the tapes home every night and bring them back in the next day and make sure they had off-site backups. And that best practice kind of went away over time. We started to rely on on-prem backups. We started to rely on real-time backups and cloud backups. Ransomware authors know this. They go after backup files. It's one of the first things they're going to try and hit and encrypt as well. They want to take away your safety net, your safety blanket, and make sure that you have to pay the ransom. So make sure you've revisited your backup regime and that you've got at least one offline backup mechanism that is always offline unless you're running the backup. That gives you space to recover. Other best practice stuff, access control. There are basic security principles that I'm sure we all know, but how many of us actually implement them on a day-to-day basis? Need to know. You need to make sure that the people in your organization only have access to the data they need to have access to get the job done, and no access to any other data, not just to combat ransomware, but for general best practice in security. Implement the principle of need to know. And alongside that, principle of least privilege, or privilege. Principle of least privilege. Make sure that if someone only needs to be able to read data, that's the only thing they can do to that data. They can't modify, they can't write to that data. Work it out. Model your business. Work out how you can apply those principles within your organization. Make sure that you can keep current with patching. I think the problem with talking about patching is when you're someone who's a technology implementer or responsible for managing the security of technologies, it must be very frustrating to hear people say to you, keep current with patches, apply all the patches all the time and never fall behind, and make sure you patch on the day the patch is released. And you all sit there and go, fuck off, that's not possible. It's not possible. And I think it's unhelpful that you get preached to in that way that often, that everyone's saying, manage your patching, make sure your patching is done. It's approaching the problem from the wrong side. We talk too much about patch management. We need to talk very much more about vulnerability management. It's about making sure that you're aware of which vulnerabilities exist within your organization. It's about making sure that you can do something to mitigate against exploit of those vulnerabilities while you manage the patch window and the patch rollout and the backout plan and the QA process for all of those patches. What are you doing about the vulnerabilities? Patch management is easy. Vulnerability management is more difficult. That's where you need to approach it from. And going along with one of the questions that we had earlier on about what is one of your biggest challenges, education, 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 to quote Tony Blair, of all the criminals I could quote. Oh, yes, politics. That's why Ian Levy's not here, you see, you can't say things like that. Make sure that you are keeping your employees current with what does the threat look like, not just what does it look like, but how does it arrive? How do I recognize it? And over and above all of that, I think your most powerful tool when it comes to education is empowerment. Making sure that everyone who works for the organization has a mindset and a feeling that says, if you want to get to my organization, you've got to come through me first. You empower them to know that they are your first and best line of defense. Help them to realize the power and the strength that they bring to the organization from a security level. They can change outcomes. So that's ransomware. Something else that's been really big over the course of 2016, and certainly for the 2 years prior to that, it's been ramping up and ramping up, is business email compromise, or CEO fraud, or invoice scams. There are many different names for it. The latest figures I saw that were published by the FBI have now put this as a $5 billion US dollar fraud. So over the course of 3 years, they think $5 billion has been lost to business email compromise. There are many different guises: CEO fraud, supplier swindle, account compromise. There are attacks aimed at HR for harvesting information in order to facilitate further business email compromise attacks. In a nutshell, it's such a simple attack, you wouldn't believe that it works. But when it's generating $5 billion, then you can be sure that it is working. it basically revolves around an attacker doing their research into an organization, doing a bit of mapping, who works in which department, working out who's important, working out who has clout, compromising an email account belonging to an important individual within an organization, someone at MD level, CEO level, using that compromised account to send emails to someone else internal with socially engineered pressure to pay an invoice. So sending an email from the CEO to the director of finance saying, it's usually like Friday afternoon, and you say, hey, I'm the CEO, and I'm just about to get on an airplane, but we've got this really important invoice that needs to be paid, and it's got to be paid by end of business today. Can you make sure it gets paid now, and make sure you send me confirmation? And even if the recipient begins to query this and go, hold on, we're going outside process, this is a bit weird, the attacker controls that inbox, so can respond in real time and delete the queries that have come in from the victim, so the real owner of the inbox maybe doesn't see them, and they get to engineer and facilitate payment. And it's through these simple email-based social engineering scams that billions of dollars are going missing from organizations. Here's one example, $500,000 gone. This was an email from the CEO of AF Global to the director of accounting within the same firm. This is a direct quote from the email, basically making the director of accounting feel important, making him feel good. Hey, I've assigned you this case with this really cool sounding James Bondy case number. You're not allowed to talk to anybody else about this, and the only correspondence about this threat should come to me through this account because it's super confidential, and if you talk to anybody else, we're going to be in trouble with the SEC. So no email, no phone, only me, only this account, because obviously this account is under the control of the attacker. And by the way, you may have already heard from Stephen Shapiro from KPMG. But you'll notice in the first mail, there's no request for payment, there's no mention of money. It's just the setup, the engineering. And of course, so Glenn Worm feels important. This is great. Oh, I'm part of some mergers and acquisition top secret stuff. About half an hour after the initial email, of course, the victim gets a phone call, as if by magic, from Stephen Shapiro at KPMG, saying, hey, yeah, there are some due diligence fees related with this mergers and acquisition activity that need to be paid. It's pretty much $500,000, and I'm going to send you an email with the instructions for wiring that information. But remember, you can't talk to anyone. So, of course, this all, in his head, this all checks out. This is exactly what should be happening. So he paid the $480,000 to the Agricultural Bank of China, made the transfer as requested. It wasn't until a few days later when he got a follow-up email asking for $13 million that he thought maybe he should ask someone else's opinion of transferring these kinds of funds out of the organization. You know, if we had ages to talk about it, I could give you an example from within the EU as well. This is not just a US thing, but if you look up online, a company called Leoni AG, L-E-O-N-I, it's a German organization. They had to issue a press release because they lost 40 million euros in one fraud through business email compromise. Just go find the press release on their own site. This stuff is real. This stuff happens, and it's simple. Email-based social engineering. It's not all about the malware. What about exploits and exploit kits? Well, 2016 saw the demise of the Angler exploit kit, which was far and away the most capable and best exploit kit out there. The FSB in Russia went after a gang of criminals who were responsible, they believe, for the Lurk banking Trojan. Turns out the same people were responsible probably for Angler, because once those people were arrested, Angler exploit kit took a nosedive, and everybody started to migrate to Neutrino. Because obviously, if you're a customer of the Angler group, you want to get your details out of their database as quickly as possible, because that database is now in FSB hands, and you certainly don't want to be updating them with your contact information. So they moved over to Neutrino, and of course, Neutrino spotted, you'll notice Neutrino tailed off as well, but Neutrino, like any good sales and marketing organization, were looking at their competitors, namely Angler, spotted a gap in the market, and decided that after Angler disappeared, they could double their sale price. It's just sales and marketing. Their best competitor's gone. They know they're the next best exploit kit out there. They doubled their price overnight. They saw all the new business coming in from ex-Angler customers and decided to make some money. Then they got a little bit spooked and took the whole thing private, but they made some money in the meantime. On the plus side, when we talk about exploit kits, what about vulnerabilities? Obviously, exploit kits rely on the addition of exploits relating to new vulnerabilities. Well, what you're looking at here is a year-on-year comparison of how vulnerability, how many vulnerabilities have been added to exploit kits. And you can see there's a massive and marked decrease between 2015 and 2016. That's why we haven't seen a major competitor to Angler and Neutrino emerge yet. Are we looking at the demise of exploit kits? I'm not sure. But I think one thing that we are looking at are two successes within the software and security industry. I think people are, by and large, certainly for the larger vendors, creating better code, focusing more on a secure development lifecycle, doing more testing before stuff is released, and getting patches out there on a timely basis. I think also the bug bounty programs that have slowly become more established and more remunerative for researchers are having a massive positive impact as well, in that bugs and vulnerabilities are getting reported, whether it's to the vendor or to bug bounty, cross-industry bug bounty programs, and those programs are able to work with the vendor, make sure that the hole gets closed before the vulnerability is made available on the underground or to the general public. So we've seen a massive tail off, which is great news. What else? IoT. I know James is going to talk to you a little bit about IoT and IoT exploits because we cobbled this presentation together in 25 minutes before we came on the stage. So a little bit about IoT. It's important to recognize that IoT is not the future. IoT is the present. IoT is already deeply embedded in many, many industries. It's deeply embedded, excuse the term, in the medical industry. We're talking about implants. We're talking about medical equipment within hospitals. It's deeply embedded within agriculture, whether it's wind sensors, soil acidity sensors, whether it's using drones for crop spraying. This stuff is already happening. Automated greenhouses with all of their associated sensor and connected technology. It's deeply embedded within the home. It's deeply embedded within smart cities. All of these things already exist. But not only that, it's part of a long-lasting continuum. When I was looking for when did this stuff start, The earliest reference I could find dated all the way back to 1926, which was Nikola Tesla talking in a newspaper interview just after the advent of wireless technology about how he envisioned the future. And he's basically describing the world that we live in right now. You know, domestic management, heat, light, and household mechanics. We do that now. Having your newspaper printed wirelessly in the home, that's your iPad. This is what we do now. Innumerable transmitters and receivers. So this is part of a continuum. It's not something that sprung up out of nowhere. The problem is that, by and large, the people responsible for the creation of this continuum of technology have nothing to do and care little to nothing about security. Their driver is the creation of the market. How do I get to market first? How do I create a market? And how do I capture the customers? How can I innovate successfully and attract people to be my customers? But it's set to have an explosive future. You know, when we talk about years like 2020, for some reason, I don't know if it's the same for you, but for me, 2020 still seems like ages in the future. Like the 21st century still seems like ages in the future. But we're already there. 2020 is 3 years away, less than 3 years away. So these predictions are about next week, next month, tomorrow. This is the kind of world we're looking at. More than 3.3 billion connected devices just in smart cities alone. Just China as a nation is talking about moving 950 million people, that's more than all of Europe, into smart cities by 2025. This is now, this is current. And the people responsible for developing this kind of technology are not looking at security right now. We need to engage with them. You need to engage with them. When your customers, you need to start asking about the security aspect of these devices as well as the functional aspect. You need to drive those requirements. And we need to, from a security industry perspective, drive the knowledge and the realization that security is an integral part of what they do. Because right now with IoT and connected devices, who's responsible? Well, it's mostly you. You get to choose what you're going to buy, what you're going to connect, how you're going to configure it sometimes, or just whether you're going to connect it. And the responsibility is down to you. But as it moves out more into smart cities and smart infrastructure and smart agriculture, as it's already doing, you can no longer be responsible because you no longer have control. You're simply living in an environment created by smart and connected and interconnected technology. So the choice is being taken away from you. What are the risks? Finding the right pictures is always a challenge. What are the risks? The risks mostly divide into two categories. Privacy is one. And obsolescence is the other. Does anyone recognize the image on your right? That's a portable microfilm reader, which at one point was an extremely useful piece of technology to have and now completely obsolete. And the rate of obsolescence is speeding up and accelerating at an incredible, incredible rate. So these are the risks, privacy and obsolescence. And they diverge into many different factors. How are those risks realized? Whether it's threat actors, whether it's being recruited into an IoT-based botnet, these are things that we've already seen, whether it's misconfiguration, whether it's poor coding, whether it's extortion-related activity, these are all your internal factors, or it might simply be weather-related, or power or infrastructure-related, or there may be commercial concerns driving development of stuff which you have no influence over. There are only certain areas where you can influence, but it's important to recognize the kinds of effects that these things can have on you. Right now, a lot of the research around connected devices tends to focus on the device itself, because that's legal, and that's nominally more simple, and you won't go to jail for it. You can buy a device, you can take it apart, you can look for vulnerabilities. But where people are really not looking, because it tends to be illegal unless you're invited, is the back end. Connected technology is about data. It's about collecting data, sending it somewhere, and mining it, and building conclusions out of it, and making it relevant, and generating income from data. That's the back end. That's the data center. Now, those devices may have vulnerabilities in and of themselves, but you've also got to look at what route does that offer into the data center? Is it even my data center? What are the people doing with the data? How is it protected? Can I audit somehow this back end infrastructure? Can I bring it in-house? Can I control it? These are questions that you need to be asked. Or if there's a weakness in the data center, does that give an attacker a route into my enterprise? Because there's a path that exists there. What kind of protection is applied? And it goes along with what James was saying about the iOS ecosystem. There's a distinct lack of opacity in IoT-related devices right now. It's very difficult to look under the hood. This isn't tomorrow, like I said. Real-world attacks. Mirai Botnet is already massively famous, as is malware tech now. He wasn't when I nicked this image. The person behind the Mirai code before it went public on underground forums was boasting of being able to recruit up to 380,000 devices at any one time. So his botnet was vastly bigger than that. And these were mostly connected devices, not traditional computing platforms. So these attacks are already real. The failures are already real. Do you know what you're looking at here? Other than the side of a truck? You're looking at a place where a connected device killed someone. This is the side of the truck that the Tesla drove into, because the Tesla was unable to distinguish the side of the truck from the sky, and the driver was killed when it hit this truck. This is a real-world failure of connected technology, having real-world life or death consequences. This stuff is now. This is already happening. And obsolescence. Obsolescence is happening now. It's kind of a dumb story, and it's kind of funny, but it's real. The lock, the neon lock. Fantastic innovation, your IoT-connected padlock, and then the company went out of business. And then you couldn't unlock your padlock unless you could take it back to the retailer to be unlocked. But it was probably attached to something if it was locked. You're going to have a problem.
But there are exploits, so it's okay.
So it's fine. Chick. Or you have to wait 180 days, and then it would apparently unlock by itself, which seems weird. But then when you think one of the things that we did at our corporate customer and partner event a couple of weeks ago was simply use the Tesla API to steal a Tesla without exploiting any vulnerabilities or using any exploits, simply using the API as designed, we were able to locate, unlock, and drive off in a Tesla. You begin to understand that there's not a lot of thought going into the back end of connected devices. The Revolve Hub was the same. It was acquired by a competitor because they were doing something similar and they wanted Revolve out of business, so they put them out of business and everyone was left with a very expensive paperweight on their desk, all of their customers. End of the story. So leaving you with a few questions to consider, and maybe you can throw some of them back at us later on. For the enterprise, this is what you've got to consider. How do you identify this stuff? How do you identify the vulnerabilities? How do you manage them? How do you monitor the devices? What's on your network? What's actually out there? And I know James is going to dig into a lot of that in a second. How do you mitigate unauthorized access to devices? What are the consequences of unauthorized access to all of these various different devices that are being incorporated within your network environment? Do they represent any new way of losing data or being compromised by outside actors? How are you going to map out the data flows for non-human interactive systems, things that are making autonomous decisions and exchanging data in between themselves? What about if somebody maps out your business process and makes a couple of configuration changes that you don't know about, and the end result of that business process ends up making them money and you never notice? What happens there? Obviously, compliance is a massive issue. GDPR around the corner is going to make a big difference to that as well. And importantly, connected devices are about generating data to generate functionality and money. What are you doing about that data? It's growing at an exponential rate in terms of the amount of data stored and collected. What are you doing? If you're a manufacturer of devices, I think there's one really important question for you, and that's help. If you're a company responsible for the creation of these kinds of devices, you've got to recognize that you can't do it alone, and you need to reach out to the security industry, to experts, to researchers, to partners, and realize the importance of security and the fact that there are skill sets out there that can help you build a more secure ecosystem. It's our future that we're talking about, and we owe it to ourselves to make sure that that future is a more secure one. Over to you, James.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Appreciate, again, all the patience you've demonstrated in this session. I am going to have to go through some of this with greater brevity than I wanted to. I've got a couple of demonstrations where I'll focus on the key points, but I actually have videos of the whole thing. So I'll put the whole video up so that you can look at the remainder of it and go through it at a slower pace, because I know this is going to be a bit of an assault on you of me ranting at high speed. Frankly, it's one of my standard presentations, right? So I wanted to briefly touch on a couple of interesting things happening in ransomware and just a little bit in the world of Internet of Things, because I've been talking about that for a couple of years, and we're starting to get to a point of greater specificity of what the issues actually are. I want to show you a couple of these failures hands-on so you can see how we're reverting some of our security lessons back 10 or 15 years with an ecosystem of thousands of companies that, unlike Microsoft, Apple, and the Linux distribution model, haven't been forged in the fire of continual mistakes and learning tough lessons. Over the past 24 months, that huge love of ransomware that Rick talked about from the cyber criminals, we've seen a huge increase in the use of email with non-executable attachments, documents, as a means to propagate malicious code. Increasingly sophisticated and convincing snares, the likes of "this document is protected," deviations from what people expect, you know, the comical bad grammar, dodgy link image emails that many would often talk about. We've seen creative and bizarre uses of as many different languages as possible to stitch together campaigns that almost look like people gluing together different parts of toolkits, copying and pasting each other's code, and slowly trying to make their own version of campaigns. And that's a really interesting thing to pick apart in ransomware. There are cases here where people have produced really competent ransomware, high quality malicious code, the likes of the Petya campaign, or Petya, a piece of ransomware that was so close to an amazing implementation. They wrote their own bootloader in 16-bit real segmented memory mode. Like, I read about that when I was a kid, and it's hairy stuff, you know? It makes throwing a knife in the air and catching it with your teeth look like fun. They nearly got that implementation perfect and made a crypto flaw that rendered the entire campaign useless. Another gang came along, hollowed out that bit of code, took the rest of their campaign and hijacked it for their own purposes. We're now seeing examples of ransomware gangs that have been in business over 2016 faking it and pretending to be WannaCry. They're using the PR value of WannaCry, using the WannaCry extension and README to try and get a higher conversion rate on their campaign. And for some bizarre reason, including really strange fragments of text, which is a super throwback to like 2007 and 2008. Yeah, the old, I'm putting Shakespeare into my anti-spam avoidance strategy. So there's lots and lots of really interesting and different convincing snares. Aside from gangs just copying each other, one of the big trends here that's driving this is the continued professionalization of ransomware as a service. And this, even for a security researcher that lives in this world day to day, is really in a place of sublime to ridiculous. I was browsing around on a website that really is the search engine for the dark net. This is a real web page. It's not Photoshop. It actually exists. It's very handy if you need to go find some, you know, malware or criminal services. Not only do they offer an excellent search engine of the dark web, they also offer money laundering services. They actually have a wonderful Bitcoin washing service, where for a nominal fee, you can hand over your Bitcoins. They wash them, destroying the trail to the original money, and give you tumbled Bitcoins back. So cyber criminals are developing lovely end-to-end cybercrime front ends now. I went searching on this service. By the way, if you're wondering what all this stuff in the background here, that is actually a hexadecimal dump of the picture from the beginning of the presentation that I just wanted to put in there as a mimic response. It's actually the output of DevU Random. I thought it looked cool. If you search in here for ransomware, you'll find a horrifying number of vendors offering guides, how-tos on, you know, creating your own Bitcoin stealing network or creating your own ransomware. One of the campaigns, which I was going to demo in full, and I'll put the video online, actually is really interesting here because they're a case of cyber criminals succeeding in spite of themselves. This is a campaign that started early in 2016. There are now lots and lots of different versions of it, and they are one of the gangs that are now passing themselves off as WannaCry. This particular piece of malware is sold on the dark web in a variety of different places by this user. And you can see they've got a lovely market rating system. 75 positive feedback ratings from cyber criminals. You know, so obviously this is a trustworthy cyber criminal. Super evil method. I guess that's good in this context. You know, many stars for stealth, quality and value for price. Not sure what that really means, but sure. Of course, there are competitors. This one here, Philadelphia Ransomware, new version, cheap, all automatic, undecryptable. It's like military grade decryption. Updated bonus, 20% off discount, limited offer. And if you actually go through it, they have a link to a product marketing video. And I've got to be honest, it's better than most actual products that I've seen online. It does have some extremely fast-paced speedcore 230 BPM music attached to it, which is pretty weird. But they have marketing. I mean, it's astounding, the overtness of this stuff. But before we get into the, oh, cyber criminals are amazingly organized and professional and you know, we can't possibly win rant that you might attribute to cyber criminals. Let me just show you something interesting about this little campaign here. I've got a copy of this particular sample, and if I just grab a quick copy of it, we'll have a little look around it. Okay, I'll zoom in on the pertinent stuff. This particular piece of malware has been obfuscated, so it's really annoying to open up with the likes of IDA. I'm going to open it with a tool called ILDASM, which is a tool released as part of Microsoft's NetFX debugging tools. This is a toolkit piece of malware you buy and compile yourself as a cyber criminal, and you can customize it. Now, if we look through this little guide here, I'm just going to expand a few things, okay? Well, first and foremost, looking in here in the main tools bit, we can see tools.hacking, blocker, and locker. Well, pro tip, if you're trying to create obfuscated malware, you know, probably don't put things related to hacking in the middle of it. That aside, if we go into the locker bit, there's this bit called encryption password. Okay, well, we'll open that up. Encryption password equals. This particular piece of malware has followed crypto best practice in the sense that they don't write their own crypto code. They use the one in the Windows API, right? And I wish there was a lot of legitimate software vendors we could follow that best practice with. But then they've gone and put the password in plain sight. What's really fun is if you take this password and you search for it on the dark web, you actually find something really interesting. What you find is the documentation produced by this vendor on how to configure the malicious code. And you'll notice the documentation has beginner mode, advanced mode, and paranoid mode. Obviously, I immediately clicked on paranoid mode. I mean, who wouldn't in this room, right? Now, they're not perfect. This particular documentation includes a variety of stealthing aspects. You can customize the amount of money that you want to demand. You can customize the password. This most popular incarnation of this ransomware has the default password because cyber criminals don't RTFM. So we get back to the documentation here, and we notice that by default, this piece of malware will pretend to be a copy of the Firefox application. But you'll notice they fail to scrub the original file name, bitcoinblackmailer.exe. Great job, guys. Great job. Well, let's dive into this a little bit deeper here. I know some of this is small, so let me zoom in a tad. There's a section in the documentation entitled Avoid Suspicion. Sounds handy. Note the name of your exe, innocent software, should be different from the ones you'll set below, malware 1 and malware 2. You can rename it as follows, and here you can see the default Firefox values that it includes. So we're getting some handy tips on how to avoid suspicion from the cyber criminals. Down below, we have a snap of the encryption password and extension, where we see the default value. But even more alarming here is they actually give you some really handy tips on how to avoid detection. What this does is prevents the malware from activating until a certain date. And they say, imagine a scenario. When you spread your software in a forum, you put it in, someone downloads it, activates it, they comment immediately, don't download virus. If you set it to activate to 10 days or even 2 months later, a lot of people think, meh, this software doesn't work, and get a surprise. So we're getting sales and infection tactics from the cyber criminal, not just technical tips here. We can customize every aspect of it. They even give us some really lovely advice about how to price it in the documentation to make sure that people will actually pay it. And there are some comical examples of this in circulation now. I found one from this malware gang the other day that asks for $400,000 worth of Bitcoin to unlock your computer. Now, maybe some of you have data worth $400,000. You know, I'd probably just buy a new computer and start again. It seems easier at that point. But this is the templating world of ransomware that we live in. The scary thing is, these are very, very successful in spite of being hideously implemented. We saw a hugely successful campaign with WannaCry by virtue of a borrowed exploit combined with moderately average code, where we see forums of people creating toolkits